I do believe this would be a richer country if all Americans could do a little tongue aerobics and learn to pronounce kh, a sound more commonly associated in this culture with phlegm, or kh, the sound usually made by actors in the final moments of a choking scene. It's like adding a few new spices to the kitchen pantry. Move over cinnamon and nutmeg. Make way for cardamom and somal. Exotic analogies aside, having a foreign name in this land of Joes and Marys is a pain in the spice cabinet. When I was 12, I decided to simplify my life by adding an American middle name. This decision serves as proof that sometimes simplifying one's life in the short run only complicates it in the long run. My name, Firuzeh, chosen by my mother, means turquoise in Persian. In America, it means unpronounceable, or I'm not going to talk to you because I cannot possibly learn your name and I just don't want to have to ask you again and again because you'll think I'm dumb or you might get upset or something. My father, incidentally, had wanted to name me Sarah. I do wish he had won that argument. To strengthen my decision to add an American name, I had just finished fifth grade in Whittier, where all the kids incessantly called me ferocious. That summer, my family moved to Newport Beach, where I looked forward to starting a new life. I wanted to be a kid with a name that didn't draw so much attention, a name that didn't come with a built-in inquisition as to when and why I had moved to America, and how was it that I spoke English without an accent, and was I planning on going back, and what did I think of America? My last name didn't help any. I can't mention my maiden name because, Dad, I'm writing a memoir. Great, just don't mention our name. Suffice it to say that with 8 letters, including a Z and 4 syllables, my last name is as difficult and foreign as my first. My first and last name together generally serve the same purpose as a high brick wall. There was one exception to this rule. In Berkeley, and only in Berkeley, my name drew people like flies to baklava. These were usually people named Amaryllis or Chrysanthemum, types who vacationed in Costa Rica and to whom lentils described a type of burger. These folks were probably not the pride of Poughkeepsie, but they were refreshingly non-judgmental. When I announced to my family that I wanted to add an American name, they reacted with their usual laughter. Never one to let mockery or good judgment stand in my way, I proceeded to ask for suggestions. My father suggested Fifi. Had I had a special affinity for French poodles or been considering a career in prostitution, I would have gone with that one. My mom suggested Farah, a name easier than Firuzeh, yet still Iranian. Her reasoning made sense, except that Farah Fawcett was at the height of her popularity, and I didn't want to be associated with somebody whose poster hung in every post-pubescent boy's bedroom. We couldn't think of any American names beginning with F, so we moved on to J, the first letter of our last name. I don't know why we limited ourselves to names beginning with my initials, but it made sense at that moment, perhaps by the logic employed moments before bungee jumping. I finally chose the name Julie, mainly for its simplicity. My brothers, Farid and Farshid, thought that adding an American name was totally stupid. They later became Fred and Sean. That same afternoon, our doorbell rang. It was our new next-door neighbor, a friendly girl my age named Julie. She asked me my name, and after a moment of hesitation, I introduced myself as Julie. "What a coincidence," she said. I didn't explain that I had been Julie for only half an hour. Thus, I started sixth grade with my new, easy name, and life became infinitely simpler. People actually remembered my name, which was an entirely refreshing new sensation. All was well until the Iranian Revolution, when I found myself with a new set of problems. Because I spoke English without an accent and was known as Julie, people assumed I was American. This meant that I was often privy to their real feelings about those damn Iranians. It was like having those X-ray glasses that let you see people naked, except that what I was seeing was far uglier than people's underwear. It dawned on me that these people would have probably never invited me to their house had they known me as Firuzeh. I felt like a fake. When I went to college, I eventually went back to using my real name. All was well until I graduated and started looking for a job. Even though I had graduated with honors from UC Berkeley, I couldn't get a single interview. I was guilty of being a humanities major, but I began to suspect that there was more to my problems. After 3 months of rejections, I added Julie to my resume. Call a coincidence, but the job offer started coming in. Perhaps it's the same kind of coincidence that keeps African Americans from getting cabs in New York. Once I got married, my name became Julie Dumas. I went from having an identifiably ethnic name to having ancestors who wore clogs. My family and non-American friends continued calling me Firuze, while my coworkers and American friends called me Julie. My life became one big knot, especially when friends who knew me as Julie met friends who knew me as Firuze. I felt like those characters in soap operas who have an evil twin. The two, of course, can never be in the same room since they're played by the same person, a struggling actress who wears a wig to play one of the twins and dreams of moving on to bigger and better roles. I couldn't blame my mess on a screenwriter. It was my own doing. I decided to untangle the knot once and for all by going back to my real name. By then, I was a stay-at-home mom, so I really didn't care whether people remembered my name or gave me job interviews. Besides, most of the people I dealt with were in diapers and were in no position to judge. I was also living in Silicon Valley, an area filled with people named Rajiv, Avishai, and Insuk. Every once in a while, though, somebody comes up with a new permutation, and I am once again reminded that I am an immigrant with a foreign name. I recently went to have blood drawn for a physical exam. The waiting room for blood work at our local medical clinic is in the basement of the building, and no matter how early one arrives for an appointment, 40 coughing, wheezing people have gotten there first. Apart from reading Golf Digest and Popular Mechanics, there isn't much to do except guess the number of contagious diseases represented in the windowless room. Every 10 minutes, a name is called, and everyone looks to see which cough matches that name. As I waited patiently, the receptionist called out, "Fritzy! Fritzy!" Everyone looked around, but no one stood up. Usually, if I'm waiting to be called by someone who doesn't know me, I will respond to just about any name starting with an F. Having been called Fruzy, Frizzy, Fiorucci, and Fruz, and just plain, I am highly accommodating. I did not, however, respond to Fritzy, because there is, as far as I know, no T in my name. The receptionist tried again, "Fritzy, Fritzy, dumbass!" As I stood up to this most linguistically original version of my name, I could feel all eyes upon me. The room was momentarily silent as all of these sick people sat united in a moment of gratitude for their own names. Despite a few exceptions, I have found that Americans are now far more willing to learn new names, just as they're far more willing to try new ethnic foods. Of course, some people just don't like to learn. One mom at my children's school adamantly refused to learn my impossible name and instead settled on calling me F-word. She was recently transferred to New York, where, from what I've heard, she might meet an immigrant or two, and who knows, she just might have to make some room in her spice cabinet. Waterloo. My father is a proud man. He was the first member of his family to study in America, the first to win a Fulbright scholarship, and years later, the first to settle permanently in America. Because of him, his siblings and their families ended up in Southern California, where they all live within half an hour of each other. "I am the Christopher Columbus of the family," he always says. Nothing, however, has made my father as proud as his role as the family swim instructor. In Iran, people learn to swim on their own, if they learned at all. My mother, like most women of her generation, never learned to swim. Neither did four of her five sisters or her brother. This was the norm. My father, always the progressive man, decided that every one of his children and his nieces and nephews would learn to swim. Abadan, having been built by the British, contained many luxuries not readily found in other areas, including a clubhouse with a large pool. Every summer, my relatives came from all over Iran to stay with us, and sure enough, it was always some child's turn to learn to swim. Like a game show host announcing the next contestant, my father would say, "This summer, it's your turn, Mahmoud." My father had a perfect track record, a topic he loved to talk about. "I have a gift," he'd always say. We had all resigned ourselves to having to listen over and over again to his description of the exact moment at which each niece and nephew learned to swim and the spellbinding tension leading up to it. Mahmoud said, "Uncle Kazem, I can't do this." And I said, "Yes, you can." And he lifted his arm like this, and I pushed him a little bit, and he kicked like this, and he started to swim like a fish. So I said, "Hey, you never told me you knew how to swim." He'd always end those riveting tales by telling us, "You should have been there." We were all glad we hadn't been. The stories were interesting the first 14 times, but beyond that, they became the equivalent of the neighbor's vacation slides showing the cathedrals of France from all angles. Unfortunately, there just wasn't much anyone could do to put an end to these tales. Each new swimmer represented a victory, and talking about it made my father relive his moments of glory over and over again. The twinkle in his eye, the excitement in his voice, the pride in his face all made it clear that my father would never stop retelling his stories. History, however, has shown us that even the greatest of generals must eventually face defeat in battle, and thus was carved my destiny. I was my father's Waterloo. My father, an engineer, had an entirely logical approach to teaching his students to swim. In a methodical manner, he would explain all the necessary ingredients in swimming. Your head goes like this, thus creating buoyancy. Your feet go like this, thus propelling you forward. Your arms go like this to steer you. You put it all together and you've got it. Hearing him explain it made swimming seem as easy as baking a Betty Crocker cake from a mix. You just add water and there you go. The cerebral approach worked on all of my father's swimming students, most of whom, not coincidentally, grew up to be engineers. I, however, needed something else. I've never been interested in why exactly an airplane can fly. I want to know if the pilot has had enough sleep. In learning to swim, I just wanted to know that I wasn't going to die. My father, however, never quite understood the role of anxiety in my fruitless swimming lessons. He eventually decided that perhaps if he yelled or hurled insults, I might learn more quickly. "You're like a rock! You're hopeless! What's wrong with you?" This method may work wonders in the army, but it didn't work with me. I now had two hurdles to overcome: fear of water and fear of being in the water with my father. After a couple summers worth of lessons, I had managed, by age 6, to learn nothing, setting an all-time failure record for my father. In hindsight, I believe my ability to dodge all learning opportunities did reveal a certain inner strength, a persistent refusal to be like the others. But the British never appreciated Gandhi's persistence, and my family didn't appreciate mine. My father eventually decided that we didn't actually have to be in a pool for him to get angry with me for not knowing how to swim. He started to have a somewhat Pavlovian reaction toward me. If anybody used the word swim, my father would glare at me with a combination of shame and anger, a look that said, "I wish I had kept the receipt." To save face, he had come up with a theory of why I couldn't swim. "She's built like a rock," he'd always say. "She just sinks." This wasn't entirely true. I had never actually let go of my father in the pool, preferring instead to cling to him like a koala on a eucalyptus branch during an earthquake. His determination to peel me off himself matched, but did not exceed my determination to hold on to him. Sadly enough, my father stopped talking altogether about his glorious swimming lessons. He knew that no impressive tale could match his one big failure, moi. He finally announced to the world, which for us consisted of my aunts, uncles, and cousins, that some people are incapable of swimming. "Firuzeh is one of them," he concluded. When I was 8 years old, we went to Switzerland to visit my aunt Parveen, my mother's sister. Aunt Parveen has always been considered something of a deity in our family because she managed, despite being an Iranian woman of her generation, to become a doctor and to set up a successful practice in Geneva. The woman overcame so many hurdles to reach her dream that she deserves to have her likeness carved in marble. The fact that she actually lives in Switzerland further adds to her allure. Iranians have always considered Switzerland the apogee of civilization, a small, clean country where bus drivers don't have to check for tickets since everyone is so genetically honest. Besides, Switzerland has never particularly welcomed Iranians, thus accruing the magnetism that comes only with repeated rejection. Aunt Parveen told my father that she was going to teach me how to swim. My parents decided to leave me with her one afternoon while she worked her medical magic. It didn't occur to them that perhaps they should stay and watch the swimming lesson. My aunt took me to the deep end of the pool, and there, this highly educated woman whom I had grown up worshipping from afar let go of me. I sank. Perhaps because of her medical training, or perhaps because she couldn't face the prospect of having to explain to my parents that she had killed their child, Parveen eventually decided to intervene. Moments before I got to see the tunnel with the light at the end and the angels beckoning me to join them, she lifted me out of the water. My aunt dragged me out of the pool and, doing her best imitation of General Patton in a bad mood, announced that I was hopeless. When my parents joined us, she announced, "Firuze is a rock!" News of my European failure soon reached the rest of my relatives, thus cementing my reputation as the one incapable of swimming. Oddly enough, no one questioned my aunt's method of instruction. She was, after all, a doctor in Switzerland. My near-drowning experience brought with it an unexpected ray of hope, like a wildflower blooming in a battlefield. My family was now completely resigned to my inability to swim. My father no longer insulted me. Instead, he treated me with pity, since he now assumed that I was missing the chromosome necessary for buoyancy. His pity often led to trips to the toy store, thus proving that I was far smarter than my cousins. I managed to acquire 8 new tea sets, while my cousins had merely learned to swim. Most fruits, if left alone on a tree, eventually do ripen, especially if they're not being yelled at. It was thus that I, at the age of 10, decided that I was finally ready to learn to swim. There was, however, one proviso. I wanted to learn to swim in the sea by myself. I proudly made this announcement to my father, who, once he stopped laughing, said, "You never learned to swim in the pool, so now you want to go drown in the ocean?" That summer, we headed for our annual week-long vacation by the Caspian Sea. Because of work commitments, my father was unable to join us. My two brothers, my mother, and my aunt Sedire and Uncle Abdullah and their 4 sons, who knew how to swim courtesy of my father, headed north to the Caspian. Once we arrived, I went straight to the beach. I took a few steps into the water where a gentle wave lifted me, and I started to swim. Simple as that. When we returned to Abadan, I proudly told my father the news. He did not believe me. He and I headed straight for the pool, where he watched in disbelief. "You, Firuze," he said, shaking his head, "are an odd child." "No," I said, "there was nobody yelling at me in the sea." Years later, when we moved to Newport Beach, I discovered that one of the greatest joys in life is jumping from a boat into the deep blue Pacific Ocean. That was before I discovered snorkeling in the crystal clear waters of the Bahamas, with sea turtles and manta rays swimming around me. Later still, my husband introduced me to the cerulean waters of the Greek islands, where I spent hours swimming with the hot Mediterranean sun burning on my back. But despite my dips in the many beautiful bodies of water in the world, I have never forgotten that first gentle wave in the Caspian Sea, the one that lifted me and assured me that, yes, the pilot has had enough sleep. America, land of the free. Every Thanksgiving, my extended family and I gather at my cousin Mortaza's house. My mother brings her traditional shrimp curry. My aunt Sedire brings her lima bean rice with lamb shanks. And my aunt Fatimeh brings her homemade baklava. All the other relatives prepare their favorite Persian dishes, and we place them next to the stuffed turkey with all the trimmings. Everyone then proceeds to catch up on the latest family gossip, which usually involves rumors of impending marriages. Once all rumors have been spread and subsequently denied by all involved parties, we give thanks for our lives here in America